Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to Racing Lives. My name is Aurélie Donzelot, and in this podcast I use motorsport as an excuse to chat to some of the most inspiring women I know. Each week brings a different guest and we discuss everything from career beginnings to what it's truly like to be involved in one of the fastest sports in the world. My guest today has worked her entire professional life in motorsport, climbing up the racing ladder from Formula BMW UK via the World Touring Car Championship and A1 GP, with a touch of America's Cup for good measure, and ending up in Formula One, where she now heads up the communications function at Williams Racing and counts almost 10 years with the legendary team. She has recently become a mum for the first time to Florence, and so has paused her travelling ways momentarily while getting to grips with the new challenge of being a working mum in the fast-paced world of motor racing. She's one of my longest and closest friends in this industry, having cut our teeth in touring car racing together and climbed through the motorsport ladder at similar times. Our regular weekend catch-ups have become one of our favourite social media moments, which you may have come across. The infamous F1 grid selfies. My guest today is the highly experienced Sophie Ogg.
Oh, wow! That makes me sound like a proper person.
You are a proper person!
That was really awesome. Thanks. I love it.
On with the show.
Okay.
Tell me, Sophie, when and where did your racing life begin?
So it really goes back to the 90s, like quite a long time ago. My dad took me to a British touring car race when I was younger, and the moment I stepped inside the paddock, I was just totally captivated. I think the smells, the sounds, just the sight, the whole atmosphere just got me completely hooked. I remember saying to him, like, in that moment, you know, Dad, this is what I want to do. You know, this is where I want to work. And I think he thought I was a bit crazy. I didn't have a clue what job I actually wanted or what jobs even were available. But it was kind of there that it sort of started. So I started doing a bit of research, which was a lot harder than it is these days, and narrowed down sort of newspaper clippings, and eventually decided that I wanted to be either a race engineer, an aerodynamicist, or weirdly enough, an Anne Bradshaw, because I saw an article in the Post about Anne, who was this woman behind Damon Hill at the time. And I didn't really know what she did, but I thought that was quite a cool job as well. So I decided that I needed to get some experience. I had no idea how to get a foot in the door. I had no family or anybody that were involved in motorsport. And eventually decided to get some work experience. So when we got to sort of GCSEs and everyone was going off and doing a sort of week or two at various sort of companies, I decided it'd be a great idea to go and do 2 weeks helping a local race team back in Yorkshire, which was actually a contact through my nan. She knew somebody who's a sort of other half ran this little racing team that ran Vauxhall Juniors and gave me a number. I sort of called them up out of the blue and said, look, can I come along and do this? My school again thought I was a bit weird, but sort of checked it out and said, yeah, fine. And ever since then, I started going along to race weekends on a weekend, and every job that I've had since then has come either through a contact or recommendation from someone I've known. So it just kind of snowballed from that, really.
Wow, that's wicked.
Yeah, very, very, very surreal.
And very similar to my own as well, actually. It suddenly experienced it, pointed at it, worked that it was just a brilliant place to work, a brilliant way of working, and then had literally no connection to it whatsoever and set about finding a way in, which is wasn't easy now.
It's really
anyway,
not easy. But... Yeah, I was going to say now at least I think there's a lot more information now about what the jobs are and how to actually get in touch with people, even if it's through, you know, social media or websites or online, or, you know, there's so many places now you can find info. But back then I really struggled. So it was newspaper clippings and just kind of asking around and writing to people. I mean, I remember writing a letter to Tyrrell and getting an email back from their aerodynamicist telling me all about what aerodynamicists do.
That's amazing.
I know. And it was just, looking back, it seems kind of crazy, but it's kind of where I started. And I'm really glad that I did get in that way, because it was then genuinely that sort of, that love that drove me to kind of keep going. And every time I sort of took a different step into a different championship, it just captivated me and hooked me even more and kind of like sucked me into this kind of motorsport bubble where I just kind of loved every element of it. And you know, I never really planned for what came next, but every sort of job that I did end up going to was never a planned move. It was just kind of an opportunity that came up at the time.
That's wicked. And so, I mean, I'm getting hints of it already, but would you say that you were always a motorsport fan? Where did it come from?
I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because it was always on in the house when I was young. Like, my dad always watched Formula One. You know, I've got photos that he took going to races in the 80s of, you know, Gilles Villeneuve and people like that. And I remember watching Mansell and Senna and all these sort of great names that you sort of hear about. I think I must have absorbed it somehow, but then it was that touring car race that really kind of cemented it for me. But I don't know, maybe it was always kind of there. I think, you know, I'm a competitive person anyway, so maybe it kind of just cemented everything that I kind of love. But I think from that sort of early teens, it was definitely, I was hugely, hugely impressed by the whole world of motorsport and just wanted to know more.
What's your earliest memory of it? Can you actually remember?
I think it's really difficult, isn't it, to kind of think what's a memory and what's just something that you've learned or you've heard about over the years.
Innocent. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like that question when people say, what's your earliest memory of being a child? It's, like you sort of think that you have these memories and then you've probably been told them. I do remember Nigel Mansell though. I remember seeing him and I remember seeing all the sort of fanfare in the papers and on TV. Williams weirdly was the team that I always sort of had a connection to all the way through sort of the 90s, from Mansell to Damon Hill to Jacques Villeneuve. You know, I was hugely, hugely sort of addicted to watching it and following that team, which is why it's surreal that that's the team that I sort of ended up working with. But I think, yeah, the sort of Mansell days I really, really remember. But then I also, you know, I do remember sort of British touring cars. And when I went to this race with my dad, you know, seeing like Ricard Vidal and all these sort of drivers, and some drivers, you know, doing sort of Formula Ford and things that went on to great stuff, you know, like sort of Dan Weldon and all these people that went to America. I remember sort of seeing them in person, and Jenson Button, you know, kind of coming up through the ranks, you know, even Lewis Hamilton. I remember going to a karting race with some friends that actually karted at the time. And I remember Lewis walking past in this like sort of pristine white suit, and everyone was kind of like, oh, you know, yeah, he's sort of been picked up by an F1 team and, you know, he's quite good. And I was like, oh, okay, right, okay, fine. And then a few years later, you're like, oh yeah, he was quite good, wasn't he?
Brilliant. Okay, so you listed aerodynamicist, engineer, and Anne Bradshaw, which, as you and I know well, is communications.
Yes, legendary communications.
You clearly ended up in communication. So how was the choice made?
So I think the initial choice for me was I wanted to be a race engineer or I wanted to do aero. One of the two. It was engineering. And I kind of, all the sort of early jobs were all about sort of learning how, you know, racing cars worked. You know, when I used to go to the racetracks with all the sort of single seater teams and things, I was kind of helping out do whatever they needed. But part of it was, you know, polishing all the bodywork and washing the wheels and actually just sort of helping with any jobs with the cars to actually just try and learn a bit more about it. And I actually went to uni with that in mind. So like for my A-levels, I did physics, maths and computing with a view that I was going to be an engineer. And then I think I kind of got to the point where I figured maybe numbers weren't my strong point. I wasn't terrible, and I'm pretty sure I could have put in a lot of hard work and got there, but I seemed to be better with words. So I figured, okay, maybe that's the path for me, and maybe that's the sort of route to take. And I don't know, I think maybe that initial engineering passion has actually helped me in the sort of communication side of it, because a lot of what I do is obviously having to talk about technical things, but also working with a lot of technical people. And the fact that I genuinely have an interest and a fascination with that side of it, I think has always helped people kind of maybe give me a bit more respect and actually want to invest time in explaining and talking to me about things. So I then decided to go down the word route and sort of got a few jobs, not all in motorsport, to be honest. I did go into London at one point and work in a sort of PR agency just to get a bit of PR experience, because I figured motorsport PR is very unique and it is very different. And it's quite hard to sort of learn on the job, because generally, especially in small teams, you're the only person doing it. So you're not actually learning from anybody. So I thought it was quite valuable to do that. So I actually learned a little bit about communications itself. And then weirdly enough, one of my sort of first proper jobs was formerly BMW and the UK Championship. Mm. And weirdly enough, it was taking over from Anne Bradshaw, who had been doing that role previously. And I actually got to know her through formerly BMW. And it was a very strange coincidence, having sort of, when I'd been younger, kind of looking at these pictures of this legendary Anne, and then finally sort of meeting her. And do you know what? She's been a huge, huge influence on my career personally. And I think anyone that can find someone who's a mentor like that is really lucky, because that was so invaluable in teaching me about formerly BMW, but also, you know, she was working in World Touring Cars, she was doing a lot of work with BMW still. So we came across each other a lot, and actually our paths have crossed so many times through the years. She's recommended me for jobs. She actually recommended me for the Williams job when it came up. So I feel like I've taken over her role in a number of series. A1GP as well, you know, she kind of drafted me into A1GP. I was working for one of the teams and she sort of called me in to help out with her in the actual series, and then at Williams. And then weirdly enough, she's now my maternity cover. So, you know.
I know, I love that. I love that so much.
It's quite strange how it's kind of all come together. But it's been good.
It's lovely. I love that synergy with Anne as well, actually. I didn't realise the extent of it. I think it's brilliant.
I know. She's a great mentor and a great friend now as well. And I think there'll never be a day when I don't kind of go to her for some advice.
Would you say, I love this question so much because no one knows how to answer it. Would you say you chose motorsport or motorsport chose you?
That is an interesting question. I think motorsport chose me because, you know, like I say, that sort of captivated feeling of the sound, the smell, the atmosphere. I think that's, you know, it either gets you or it doesn't. And I think it's one of those instinctive things, you know, the first time you step in a paddock, it you're just stepping in a paddock and it's just another day out, or something happens and things change. And I think for that reason, you know, I didn't go out and look for it. I think it was just one of those things that I came across and it just sucked me in.
And it's a pretty powerful feeling, isn't it? A lot of people experience it just when they go to a race as a guest with no interest in becoming part of it, and it does suck you in.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I think even like you say, when you don't work in it, there's still something about it that you kind of step in that paddock and there's a real sense of community. And I know we always sort of talk about that whole family feeling, but it genuinely is. Even if you're not working in it day in, day out, you know, when you're in it for that weekend or for that day or for that hour even, you know, you are part of that family. And I think it is quite a unique feeling.
I love that. I love describing it as a family. Mm. We literally embrace you and don't let you go.
Yeah.
There might be some people listening to this which don't actually work in the industry, although I expect most of the listeners will be our mates. What would you say is the biggest misconception about your job?
I mean, the obvious thing is the glamour. obviously people think that clearly we just stand around taking grid selfies and drinking champagne. And I think that, you know, social media, we're probably all guilty of it, because social media, we, you know, you put on that one photo from an entire weekend that makes it look like you were just chilling out in the sun. And the sort of other 23 and a half hours in the day, you don't really document, because you were just working in an office or running around trying to keep up with things. But I think there is obviously sort of positive sides to it, but I think it's that balance of hard work. I don't think people necessarily outside the industry realise quite how much blood, sweat and tears genuinely goes into it. And not even from a Formula One side, you know, from everything that I did before I got to Formula One. I think people think that now you can kind of just step into F1 and it's easy, and that everyone should be able to just be sort of gifted this sort of job that you can just travel around and have fun. And I think actually it's easy for people to forget that, you know, we do genuinely work hard and we do have serious jobs to do. And we've all, you know, we all have put in a lot of graft to get where we have got, and you shouldn't underestimate that. And I think the other one that I would say people maybe have a misconception over is just the relationship with the media. So in communications particularly, I think there's probably a feeling of, you know, we're either sort of on the phone kind of doing this whole sort of big I am speech to media, telling them not to run stories and to keep these things out of the press, or we're sort of trying to sell them a dream that's just complete rubbish, and that it's, you know, that one person holds all the cards. Especially in Formula One, I think there's a sort of misconception that, you know, press officers hold all the cards because, you know, you're the F1 team, whereas it's totally not like that. You know, it's such a balancing act, and those relationships with the media, it's not just about demanding things and feeling like you're the one that's in control all the time. And I think if you take that attitude that, you know, you're the ball sort of in your court and you're holding all the cards, that you're going to get unstuck, because you actually need the media to be there in good times and bad, more so in bad times, to be honest. And I think how you treat them and how you build those relationships, it's give and take the whole time. You know, you are trying to give them a bit of information and they're trying to get a bit of information, and you kind of have to find a middle ground that works for both of you. So it's a lot trickier than probably people might imagine, but it's also really rewarding. And, you know, we, as you know, we've got a lot of friends in the media, and that's how you do your job better, to be honest, isn't it? By having those relationships. You know, you might not be best mates with everyone, but you know, you have to work with everybody and you have to get on with them to a certain level, and you need each other. You need each other as much, you know, they need you as much as you need them.
Definitely. It's a collaboration.
Yes.
You touched on it slightly because you referenced it as one of your character elements, which is competition. Obviously, motorsport is highly competitive. You own up to being highly competitive yourself, but we work in communication. We're not racing. And yet, I feel like we still end up being competitive in many different ways. So I wanted to ask you how you experience it in your job.
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, we are, aren't we? We're all competitive. And it's whether it's just kind of wanting our drivers to do well on the track, or wanting to be the best comms team in the paddock, or wanting to have, you know, that, you know, have your team as the voice of something that happened. You know, every time that something happens in the paddock or there's a news story, it's kind of like looking around to see which team's actually going to get involved and going to get get some coverage out of it. You'd think it was maybe a bit dog-eat-dog from the outside, but then we all get on so well. You know, all the other F1 teams, we all talk, you know, all the heads of comms, we talk a lot more than people would realise. And I think actually out of all the roles across the teams, maybe aside from the team principals, I'd say maybe the heads of comms are kind of one of the groups that maybe do communicate the most, which is probably good given that we work in communications. But, you know, the team managers do get together and they talk. But I genuinely think the comms people do kind of work quite closely together and do become a little family in themselves. And when things are happening, you know, we do try and keep each other in the loop. And, you know, it's not very often that we get caught out by what one team's doing, or that we sort of, you know, purposefully step on each other's toes. But there is obviously an element of competition. There always is. And there's an element of competition because obviously some teams are sort of more desirable to the media than others. So, you know, you're constantly sort of competing in that aspect. And if you're not competing on track, then you're competing off track to be the team that can offer something that another team can't. I think it's all a big competition, but I think it's a friendly competition. I don't think there's any harm in it. I think it's just fun, and I think it's what we all love, you know. But there's also that competition, you know, when you're going through an airport and you want to be first through security because you want to get a seat, you know, waiting to get on the plane. I mean, it's crazy, but, you know, if you can get through security quicker than even a colleague that you're traveling with, then you feel like you've got to win.
There's even that thing when we're on charter flights and we know everyone, no one wants the middle seat.
Yeah, exactly. That feeling of trying to get checked in first, and if your seat can't be changed, then you feel like you've lost. But if you've got an aisle or a window, you kind of turn around smugly like you've won a ticket. It's crazy, but it's kind of just the world that we live in, and I think it's what kind of keeps it all exciting, that there is this sort of fun element to literally everything that we do, even things that might be mundane to most people.
Literally cannot help ourselves. Talking about success, a thing I love about the sort of times we live in generally is that there's a lot of emphasis on defining success for yourself. So I wanted to ask you, you know, how do you define success for yourself, for your job?
I think there's, from my particular sort of experience, I find that I judge success on things that I keep out of the press as much as the stuff that I get in the press. So a lot of the wins that I'll feel I have, no one will ever hear about or know about, because you're not going to go and say, oh, guess what, I just kept out of the newspaper, because that would really be a bit stupid. but a lot of the time it is, and even if it is negative news, or, you know, things are tough, which, to be fair, you know, the last few years at Williams, we've had some really, really tough times. But I found it really, really rewarding, because I feel like it's a different challenge, and getting, you know, working with the media in those times and getting them to sort of frame a story and understand what, you know, what people are going through and what's actually happening, to a point that you can try and get it across in a really sort of human way, so that people can kind of understand those struggles. I think that's actually, in my eyes, is quite a success, and is quite a challenge. But then obviously there's sort of more obvious things, like, you know, dealing with a crisis. You know, 2012, for example, when we won a race, which was out of the blue. So actually dealing with that in the first instance, because, you know, I remember running down to the podium and passing someone from Red Bull going, can you tell me where I go? Because I'd never even done a recce to where the press conference rooms are and things like that, because we'd never needed it. We were nowhere near. I learned my lesson there. Do it anyway, even if we finish last. Always know where to go if we win now. Things like that are kind of a fun challenges. And obviously that was sort of obvious success. But then obviously we burnt the garage down straight after that, and it went very quickly from being a extremely positive moment where we're organizing team photos and all this kind of stuff to, you know, wow, we've just, you know, got a few people now in the medical center, a few people in hospital, you know, the garage is completely decimated, and, you know, everything went down, you know, IT went down, everything just completely stopped. And you kind of have to go, okay, right, this is a situation we've never been faced with before. Let's work through it and stay calm and manage it, and, you know, manage what we need to do externally and internally. And, you know, we got through it, and it was tough, but, you know, we did manage it. And a week later, we were in Monaco racing, which is crazy to think of now. But then, I know I'm listing quite a lot of successes here. There's a lot of ways of defining it, but it's quite a unique job. So there are different levels to it. Because then on the other side of that, there is the proactive stuff. And, you know, we don't always get the opportunity to do it. And, you know, budgets can sometimes be quite difficult in Formula One, because you kind of want to pour everything into the car. But every now and again, you can make some crazy idea become a reality. And, you know, one of those crazy ideas that we had was the big 40th anniversary extravaganza at Silverstone, yeah, where we decided, you know, I remember sitting around the table and we sort of threw the idea out and said, you know, what about just trying to put on a fan day and get all the fans involved? And everyone initially looked at me a little bit crazy, like, how's this going to happen? And then people kind of got on board and went, actually, you know what, there's something in this. And we ended up with this massive day, 40,000 fans coming and watching loads of our cars running, you know, so many of our ex-world champions. It was crazy. So stuff like that, you know, sort of ideas become reality. Putting Frank in a hot lap with Lewis, I still can't believe that I didn't get told that was ridiculous, and that we weren't going to do it. And even when we were putting him in the car, I still remember sitting there thinking, we're actually doing this. But yeah, there's fun stuff like that that's kind of real sort of small wins. Yeah, I think they're kind of a number of ways that I sort of would define success.
I loved that lap so much. I'd love seeing Frank so happy. And
it was, I mean, that was the great thing. And, you know, Claire sort of wanted to do it because, you know, Frank is a huge Lewis fan. And I remember sort of saying to Claire, you know, do you know what you're asking here? And she just kind of looked going, yeah, but he'll absolutely love it. And she was totally right. I mean, literally, his face was a picture. And he did. He absolutely loved it. And sometimes you kind of have to go, you know, from my PR communications, I'm kind of literally going through everything that could go wrong with this and thinking, is this worth it? And actually, I'm really glad that we did almost throw caution to the wind. I mean, not that we weren't safe and we did check a lot of things out. It wasn't just one of those things where we just stuck him in a car. But I am really pleased that, you know, Claire did push ahead and did kind of go, no, do you know what? We need to do this for Frank, because it was great.
Oh, completely different topic.
Yeah.
What is the moment you realised your job was not glamorous at all?
There have been so many moments like this. I think, I mean, going right back to the beginning, I think if you haven't been stood on the first corner or, you know, out sort of trying to make notes on a race on a rainy, freezing cold day at Thruxton in a support paddock, then you really don't, you haven't paid your dues. Because moments like that really do kind of make you, and you do look around and go, wow, really, what am I doing here? At that point, you realise this isn't a glamorous job.
Moving on to a slightly different aspect of your work, which is everything else. How do you manage an actual work-life balance? Because our jobs are not 9 to 5.
No, it's tricky, isn't it? And I think maybe my idea of a work-life balance is different to a lot of people's version of a work-life balance. So much so where I think over the years I've actually had bosses almost force me to try and take time off and encourage me to have a life outside of work. I think I am quite a workaholic. So actually the home side of things is the bit that I really have to force myself to do. But since I've actually started doing that, it actually makes the work side a bit easier, which I know people have been saying for years, you do need a balance. And it is true. But I think it's tricky because I don't think anybody really knows the answer to the question. And I don't think anybody has the perfect balance. I think it's just about getting a balance that works for you. I've got a really understanding family who, ever since I was 13 years old, have always understood that my weekends I want to spend at racetracks. And they've kind of gone from thinking that was mad to actually going, oh, okay, you've got quite a good job now. You do need understanding friends and family. Most of my friends are in motorsport, as you can imagine. I do have a very small number of friends who aren't in motorsport, but it probably is small for the reason of they kind of have to, you know, they stay friends with me on the basis that it's good that we can chat a lot now. So I have a lot of WhatsApp groups and things like that to kind of stay in touch with people. But generally, I'll kind of catch up with friends maybe once a year, which sounds crazy, but I mean, that's a good year. But then also kind of balancing that whole crazy, fast paced nature of things with yoga. I do a lot of yoga, and I started that a few years ago when work was getting really stressful and I kind of needed something. And I didn't know what. I've never been a big exerciser. Loads of people kind of run and kind of take their minds somewhere else doing things like that. That's really never been for me. Like, if you see me running, something's seriously gone wrong. So yoga has been really great because it's not just about sort of body, you know, it's sort of mind. And I think you do really have to look after that side of things, because when you're in any high pressure job, you've got to be able to find a way to separate things from it and to actually just slow things down for a little bit. And the other thing is sort of writing. I've always found writing has been a good way of kind of keeping that sort of home work balance thing as well, because I do a lot of writing in my personal time, but it's always been kind of my sort of therapy in a way. It's kind of how I process things. You know, I've kept a diary since I was like 10 years old. I mean, no one should ever read these because I mean, they go from talking about, you know, my favourite fizzy drink to lots of things that probably people should never hear about as I go through the years, and lots of then moaning and sort of ranting about things. But I think it's just finding those things, whatever they are, to actually be able to separate from work, whatever that may be, and spend time. But, you know, obviously this, you know, the last sort of few months, I've now got a daughter. So this is now a completely different dimension to my family and home life. It's always been very much, you know, I've very much been able to just put myself first and manage things accordingly. So that's going to be a new chapter when I kind of go back to work this time, in how I manage the work-life balance now. It's going to be a big change. And I'm kind of quite excited to see how I tackle that, because at the moment I have an idea of how that will go. I'm definitely looking forward to getting back to work. I knew that I would miss work, and I knew that I would miss racing. And as much as people told me I wouldn't, and I wouldn't care, and I would have other things to focus on, yes, I do have other things to focus on. And yes, I am very busy. And yes, Florence is amazing, but I still love motorsport and I still love my job. So I'm looking forward to working out how to combine that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You touched on it, but I wanted to ask you specifically, how do you cope with stress in your job? Because I'm not saying anybody's stress is bigger than anyone else's. I've just caught myself in what I was about to say. But I do think that the stress that we deal with in our jobs can be huge things. You know, one of the realities that we have to have every time we go racing is we may deal with somebody being injured, sometimes fatally. So not to put the focus on that, but I do think that we cope with stress. We have to know how to cope with stress. And I just wanted to check how you do that.
Yeah, I think it's a really important issue, and yeah, not to obviously sort of to dwell on it, but you know, like you say, you know, I have actually lost a lot of friends over the years, too many really, and it kind of reminds you that, you know, motor racing is dangerous, and we have all these crisis plans in place, and you hope you're never going to need them, but these things do happen. And even down from the junior formula, you know, I was really, really close to Henry Surtees. You know, I was good friends with, you know, Dan Weldon. There's lots of people over the years that I've come across, or people that I know who are close to people who have lost people. And obviously, you know, you were in the paddock with us a couple of times, unfortunately, over the last few years, where we've lost drivers, whether it be Formula 2 or Formula 1. You know, these things do unfortunately happen. And that is the kind of extreme of the stress and the scale that we have to manage. But even down to just the stress of the sort of fast pace in which we work. You know, we have a race sometimes every other week, sometimes every week, you know, away from home for 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks at a time, which takes its toll as well. You know, you are on the road, you're away from sort of home comforts, you're away from, you know, people that you can sort of turn to maybe. And, you know, you need people, you need a support network, you need a way of processing things, you need to be able to keep a kind of professional head on things to understand, and you need to have your own coping mechanisms. So, you know, for me personally, I like to talk about things, whether it's talk with someone directly involved, talk to somebody who's within that sort of wider paddock group, or maybe sometimes talk to someone who's back home and completely removed from it. You know, I feel like to deal with stress, I sort of have to process things, and then once I've processed them, I can kind of move on. And you kind of have to find your way of dealing with it, because you can't just keep it all sort of pent up inside, because you won't be able to function. It'll get to a point where, you know, I have in the past got to a point where I couldn't function because I was so stressed. I'd let everything get on top of me. You know, I was so worried about doing a good job at work and not letting things get on top of me that I actually ended up letting things get on top of me more than ever. And that was when I had to sort of start taking a step back and actually thinking, right, what's important here? You know, what do I need to do? And what things do I need to process? What do I need to deal with? What do I need to let go of? And how do I do that? And yoga for me was a good outlet. Like I said, writing was a good outlet, but, you know, yoga was a really good one for just sort of processing things in your mind. And then you just have to move on with things. And that's kind of how I kind of keep going. And I think that, you know, people just need to talk. I think don't bottle things up. Don't, you know, if something's bother you, even if you don't think that it should be something that's bothering you, like, talk to somebody, because somebody will understand. And even if you don't need an answer, even if you just need to say it, it can then sometimes help, and you can then sort of move on from it. But I think, yeah, don't bottle stuff up, because in our jobs in particular, it can get all consuming.
Definitely. And the nice thing about yoga as well, which I know is that it took you away from work. It took you into another bubble, even if it was for half an hour. Yeah. And I think that was probably a massive, massive bit.
Yeah, we do have to force ourselves to put our phones down, don't we? I mean, I think the world is guilty of it, but I think in particular, we are really bad for it. And actually having to do something where you can't be on your phone is helpful.
The moment you described, the moment where you said, actually, do you know what, I had to put things down and I turned to yoga, and that's where it started. Would you say that was your lowest point?
Yeah, definitely. I had probably about a month of it being a really kind of low point. It's probably about 5-6 years ago now. And it was sort of just before Christmas. And I remember just sort of sitting there thinking that I was so unhappy with things, and I couldn't process things, and the enjoyment had gone out of everything, and I needed to kind of get back to being me, to actually be able to do my job better. I was worrying about everything. I was worrying about work. I was worrying about home. And yeah, it was definitely a really low point. And I remember sort of, you know, looking back, it was a sort of very defined moment where I kind of went, okay, this isn't me. This is not me performing at my best, either at home or at work. And I need to find a way to deal with this stress. But at the time, I remember thinking for ages, like, what's wrong? Why am I just so, like, sort of tired and, like, fed up and getting... And I think I was getting quite snappy. And with people that work for me as well, sort of my team, who, you know, I really love, like, all the people that have kind of been in my comms team. But I think the guys at the time would probably admit that I was probably quite a difficult boss at that point, because I was just so on edge at all time that the slightest thing I would just tip, and that's not a good way to manage. And I remember sort of being pulled aside by someone saying, you know, how do you think you're managing your team? And I actually thought, you know what, if I was being managed how I was managing right now, I would hate it. And it was a real sort of wake-up call to kind of go, right, now, do you know what, what kind of manager do I want to be? What kind of person do I want to be? And how do I want to be seen at work? Yeah, it was a big turning point, I think. And the sort of few years since then, and becoming sort of head of comms, I think has really kind of, that really sort of helped me get to a place where I'd like to think now my team are much happier. Maybe don't ask them just in case.
I won't do a follow-up interview, don't worry. You touched on performance, and one of the things that fascinates me about motorsport is especially Formula One. I mean, or if you stay, let's say if you stay in the same championship or the same series for a long time, as we now are doing, it's essentially the same thing every year. And down to a point, it's actually the same thing every race weekend. The format and the, you know, the process that we go through, we're effectively doing the same thing over and over again. And yet we're all staying in it. And I know from a personal experience that it isn't actually the same every year, and it isn't actually the same every weekend. From your point of view, how do you experience it and find ways to keep learning and growing when actually you are in a similar environment week on week, year on year?
Yeah, I think you kind of sort of hit the nail on the head by saying, you know, it's actually not the same, is it? I remember someone saying to me years and years ago when I sort of started working in motorsport that if I was that interested in watching cars go around in circles, why don't I just go and sit on a roundabout?
Ouch.
And I sort of get their point, but I was like, it's really not the same. But like you say, yeah, we do, there is a sort of a nice sense of familiarity, I'd say, with race weekends and race formats and even going to sort of the same places year on year. But it is not the same. It's, you know, no day is the same, no hour is the same. Even going back to, you know, I've been to some tracks millions of times, but the memories I have of them from 2010 are totally different to the memories I have of being there in 2015 versus 2019. You know, I think that's what keeps us all involved, because you do have this reset button every year. You know, you have new drivers, you might have new technical people, you might have new, you know, engineers, you might have new people in the marketing department. There's so many things that can change, you know, owners with the sport, the way the formats actually do work on race weekends. And I think we all get quite excited by those changes as well. You know, the idea of going to a new circuit, you know, you get there and it's like, oh, you know, I've got to find where the media center is and, you know, and work out where all sort of the places that you would normally know are going to be at this track. You know, everyone says, oh, you know, there's always another Abu Dhabi, but there's never another Abu Dhabi 2019. You know, there's never another of that specific race and that specific moment. And you have to kind of enjoy every single one. And there'll be years that you look back on and go, do you know what? I really, really didn't enjoy that year. And those years I look back on now and go, wow, yeah, I would love to go back to that year because everything about it was just fun and exciting. But then you never know what next year will bring. And that is the joy of it, I think, is that you do never know what will come next in any aspect of the sport or the race weekend or the drivers or what someone's going to say next even. And so it's never the same. And I think that's what keeps us all going, really.
Would you say that's what you love the most about motorsport, or is it something else?
Motorsport is just a crazy world of unpredictability, and as much as I love organization and order and lists and planning, I love the unpredictability of it, which is really weird and probably sounds very much going against my nature for anyone that knows me, but it genuinely is. It's that anything could happen feeling. It's that you're stood in the garage, you know we might be P19 P20 on the grid, but you never know. You know, there's always that element of you never know what you're going to be dealing with today. And that is the excitement and that sort of competitiveness and just the racing. That is what really excites us. And I think, yeah, that's what kind of keeps it really fun.
I go into every single race weekend, and I don't even admit that to myself. I just realized that I do it every single race weekend, expecting the very highest performance that we can put together as an entire team across all disciplines.
Yeah.
And until that checkered flag, I do not let go of that expectation. You never know what might happen.
You never know.
Oh, we always outperform ourselves. It's not always visible, but...
But this is the thing, and wins to us aren't necessarily big wins on the outside world. You know, at the moment, getting a point for Williams is a huge victory. So, you know, you do sort of manage your expectations slightly on what is seen as a sort of a win, whether it's on track or off track. But, you know, like I said, I always think back to 2012. No one expected us to win in Spain, and we did. These things can happen.
What would you say is your least favourite thing about motorsport then?
I think my least favourite thing about motorsport it's very difficult because I think even the things that I don't enjoy about it, I kind of do enjoy, because in a weird way, like I say, you know, difficult times, long days at the circuit, you know, we moan about them at the time, but actually looking back on them, there's a lot of camaraderie and sort of making each other cups of coffee to kind of keep going.
Or dropping cake around each other's motorhomes, yeah, if we know one person's had a bad day.
Yes, that's always the highlight. We always try and do that. You see little things like that that you do just pick us all up and remind us that, you know, we're all in this together. But I think the difficult stuff is probably being away so much. As much as I love traveling, I genuinely love traveling, and I don't like staying still too long. Being away and being on the road is quite tough, and I think that's probably going to, like I said, go to another level this year, because having to leave Florence if I go to races, I know that's going to be probably the toughest thing that I've had to do. And it's going to sort of take being away from home, like I said, to another level. So I think that's the hardest thing. And I think that's the hardest thing for a lot of people in motorsport. And I think that's the bit that people don't realise, when, you know, you have a lot of fans sort of crying out for, oh, let's do a race every week. And it's like, yeah, I mean, I would love to watch an F1 race every week because I love F1. But it's not just 2 hours on a Sunday for us. You know, you're away, well, pretty much everybody in the paddock is away for a whole week if it's one race, 2 weeks if it's back-to-back races. So it's not just a case of switching on for 2 hours and then switching back off again. And there's a lot of time that goes into that. And I think that's probably the hardest thing for everyone, is just that time away and being able to still connect, like we say, with that home life when you're not at home quite a lot.
I think mine is one of my things that I'm realizing now is the sheer exhaustion. Not necessarily that comes from the actual work. It's probably just from being on a plane every other week.
Yeah.
And jet lagged. I think I've underestimated how tired I've been for the last few years.
Yeah. I mean, jet lag is definitely a tough one, and it is tiring. However, having now had a baby,
perspective.
I have a new perspective on this. And actually, looking back, I was getting so much sleep. This is a new level of tired. But I think I was very prepared for it, because jet lag is a very similar experience. So that feeling of just having to sleep whenever you can and not worry if it's the middle of the night or the middle of the day has really stood me in good stead with having a baby, because that's pretty much, you pretty much feel jet lagged at all hours of day. So I'm actually looking forward to a race to actually maybe get a night's sleep again. I've forgotten what they're like.
They're great. I highly recommend them.
Yeah, thanks.
Talk to me about another aspect, which we've kind of sort of touched on throughout this chat anyway, but one that I know you and I love on our personal means, and then we also hugely involved for our jobs, you slightly less so more recently, but you did have a massive part in it for years, and that is of course social media. Talk to me about how you approach it and what you feel about it.
Yeah, social media, it's got its plus side and it's got its negative sides, hasn't it? I think from a sort of professional perspective, it's a huge asset, and it's taken off so much since I first joined even Williams. I remember when I first joined Williams, our Twitter following was like 10,000, if that, maybe 9,000 or something. And we did like maybe one tweet a week. And I remember kind of looking at it and saying, look, do you mind if I kind of take this on? Because I think we should be doing more, if you don't mind. And luckily they said, yeah, sure, go for it. And obviously now social media is, like you say, it's an entire job. You know, I now have an awesome person managing our social media. And, you know, sort of, Adam just kind of gets stuck into everything, and I'd be completely lost without him, because, you know, I couldn't do my job on a weekend and do social media now, because there's just too much. And you've got so many outlets, which is great for getting content out, and it's also great for talking to sort of the fans, because they have this direct contact with a team that they've never had in the past. You know, like I said, when I sort of started, you know, I'm writing letters to a team hoping that they read them. Now, you know, you can be in the middle of a race even, and you can sort of send a direct message to a team, which might not always be helpful, because, you know, you might just be saying you don't agree with the strategy, but you know, you have that access, which I think is a really, really great thing. I think you just have to balance it with the, you know, the negative comments that you get. You're always going to get negative comments. Everybody on social media, whether it's personal, professional, you know, celebrities, teams, like, you're always going to get the negativity. And I think you just have to be able to take it with a pinch of salt, you know, it does give people access to say positive things, but it gives people direct access to you to say negative things. But on the whole, I think it's a really sort of great development in how we actually communicate now. I think from a personal point of view, like you say, you know, I love social media, and it plays to kind of one of my hobbies, so to speak, in that, you know, I love writing, I love photography. I said, you know, I've always kept a diary, and kind of Instagram is now my new diary. You know, I started writing a book when I went on maternity leave, because I sort of wanted to document my pregnancy and sort of write it all down. I'm pretty sure I'll never actually publish it as a book, because it would be so boring to read, but but you never know, never say never, but like snippets of it are kind of across on my sort of personal Instagram. And I have sort of one that sort of charts my sort of racing life, so to speak, which is where our great grid selfies always appear, and it's always a highlight of the weekend. But, you know, stuff like that is kind of fun, and I do kind of use it for that reason. You know, I use it just to, you know, I'm quite a nostalgic person, and I like documenting things in that way that you can then look back on. And I do regularly look back through my Instagram to like years gone by. And it's really kind of nice to remind yourself of things you've done and places you've been and events you've been part of. And I've recently started a sort of second Instagram channel, which I know we've sort of spoken about in the past, which is Racing Mum Life, which is now more geared towards me sort of documenting just my life as a mum, because I sort of started putting stuff on my normal Instagram and kind of felt a bit weird, because it was like two worlds colliding. And, you know, there are a lot of people that follow my Instagram, and I do have a lot of motorsport content on there because that's literally been my life. And I'm pretty sure they're not all that interested in every little move that Florence makes. But for me, I want to be able to document it, because I want to read it back, and I want to be able to look back through, you know, especially these like early days when she's kind of so small. So I've kind of started this, and again, you know, it's for me, and it's how I kind of approach social media. It's an outlet for me. It gives me somewhere to kind of express myself and be creative. But, you know, it's not overly time consuming. It's something that I can always do on the go. It's something that I can do at night when she's gone to bed. It's something that I, you know, be able to do when I'm traveling again. And it's writing. So like I said, it's going back to finding those things that just keep you happy outside of work. And I think social media is really great for that. And, you know, it's really nice having that engagement as well, because when you have, you know, people on the other end, so, you know, a lot of them are friends and people that I know that will comment on stuff. But it's sometimes, you know, even if it's good things or bad things, it's sometimes nice just to kind of go, has anyone else had this happen today? And you get a few people going, yeah, me too. Or, you know, I'm feeling a bit down. Yeah, let's just kind of get through this together. And equally, when something positive happens, you know, it's nice being able to share it, especially with family as well. You know, I've got a lot of family abroad, and they kind of follow my Instagram to know where I am half the time. So it's different people see different things in it. But for me, it is quite a personal thing, and I do really, really enjoy it.
My mum's actually told me in the past that she obviously checks my own Instagram and, you know, social media channels to find out where I'm and what I'm up to, but she also checks the teams.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Talk to me about the people that you have getting in touch with you. I think we're both quite aware of not necessarily the example that we're setting, because I, you know, I'm not that big-headed, but I'm aware that there are other people out there watching what we're doing as a career and are interested. And I'd love to know what advice you would give to anyone that wants to work in motorsport and that's currently looking at you as a great example of what can be achieved.
Well, thank you very much for saying that you think I'm a great example. Like you say, it is quite weird because you don't see yourself as that, but I do get a lot of messages on social media from people who do ask questions about, you know, how to get into motorsport. And I also have quite a few people that will come up to me in the paddock and ask me questions, and they'll sort of say, oh, you know, I'm really interested because I follow you on social media. And you kind of have that moment of going, oh yeah, actually social media is public, isn't it? People do follow it. You sort of forget. But I think the advice that I do always give to people is the advice of, you know, the advice I sort of had at the beginning, which is to get experience, you know, just get experience. And always amazes me when I say to people that they should go and get experience in something that's not Formula One, the amount of people who kind of look and kind of go, oh, okay, maybe it's not for me. And they're not, you know, they kind of want to go in and do F1 because they think that sounds cool, but actually they're not that interested in the job itself. So the idea of getting experience or being in a different formula just doesn't appeal to them. And to be honest, I quite like that, because I think that actually really separates the people from, you know, the people who really, really want and deserve the jobs from those who probably shouldn't do the jobs and are probably not the right people for it. Because actually getting experience, you know, it's how I did it. And, you know, you need to learn your trade. You need to be prepared to start from the bottom. You know, you need to be prepared to work hard. Yeah, there's lots of perks to the job, but if you can't take the downside as well, then you don't really deserve the perks, I guess. And there are very few perks, but they're really good ones. So I think be prepared to work hard, make contacts, learn your trade, and don't just aim for F1. You know, want to work in motorsport, learn about motorsport, and then be good enough to move into F1. That's how I did it, and that's how I would advise anyone to do it. And when people come to me and apply for jobs, it's always what I look for. That's really important to me, is that people have really shown some, you know, desire to get experience.
And what about the advice that you've been given as you go through your career? Have you got a piece of advice that still stands out, or that you still sticks in your mind, or that you still use to this day that's guiding you through what you're doing?
That's a really tough one. I think the advice about working, you know, make it about motorsport. I think that was the most important advice that I got given quite early on, was be in this for the motorsport, don't be in this for the Formula One, because I think you can very easily get distracted by the so-called glamour of F1. I mean, even we've talked about it in the past, about the, you know, the facilities and the motorhomes and the way that the whole F1 paddock operates. If I wasn't in F1, I would still love my job just as much, but I know full well that every other paddock apart from F1, pretty much, you know, the way that the comms people work is very different, how their setup is, you know, even down to where you can eat and things like that. You know, it's not all that easy to kind of operate in. F1 is a very good sort of operational machine, but motorsport is what I do it for. I do it for the motorsport, and that's kind of at the core of everything. And I think that piece of advice has always stayed with me, because it's always been true to what I believe in. So I'm not forcing myself to be a motorsport fan. I'm not kind of a big F1 fan that's going, okay, maybe I should watch other motorsport as well. No, I'm a genuine motorsport fan. And I think having that true understanding and grounding in motorsport has seen me through the years probably get all the jobs that I've got, because, like I say, I've been recommended for jobs over the years. And you know, I've hopefully gone in and done good jobs to then get recommended for other jobs. But, you know, like we say, a lot of the time we're working with engineers. And if, you know, if these people in the team, you know, the team, the boys in the garage and the sort of team principals, you know, they have to kind of respect you as a person for you to be able to do your job effectively. And that's a lot harder than it maybe seems from the outside. And I think when people realise your background and what you have done in the past, I have found that has opened so many doors, because people kind of go, oh, actually, okay, yeah, you have worked hard, and you've probably been around a lot of some of the racing tracks that we have in the cold, rainy English weather. That's always been the thing that I've sort of passed on to people, and it's always been the thing that I've kind of held on to through good times and bad, I guess.
Last question from me. It's been a good chat. It's been a really good chat. What are you looking forward to?
On a professional level, I'm looking forward to having to worry about what happens when you win a race again. I think, you know, seeing Williams do well after, you know, many tough years, that would be so, so nice to see for all the people involved. You know, it'd be great to see everybody up there. You know, it'd be great to see Claire stood on a podium taking a constructor's trophy. You know, things like that are obviously obvious things that I'm looking forward to. But also personally, you know, I'm looking forward to getting to a race, and I'm looking forward to Florence coming to a race. I'm looking forward to being able to take her into a paddock. You know, I took her to the Barcelona test when she was 10 weeks old. Yes. So she was pretty diddy. But you know, I really wanted her to experience it. And she was probably a little bit too little to really understand where she was. You know, you sort of sit her in an F1 car and she kind of looks at you like, I'd really just rather have my bottle. But, you know, I'm sure when she looks back, she'll realise that was quite a nice thing to do. But, you know, I really wanted her to experience it. And I'm looking forward to, you know, maybe in sort of a year's time, 18 months time, her being able to come and see, you know, come and see mummy at work and in the paddock where I kind of, you know, has been my home for like the last over 20 years. I don't know if she'll work in motorsport, to be honest. I don't really care if she does, but I just want her to have that opportunity to experience all those sights and sounds that I experienced when my dad took me to that first British touring car race. And if it sparks something in her, so be it. If it doesn't, then it doesn't matter. She's still experienced it. She's still seen that. And whatever she does, you know, she's going to be probably as fiercely independent and do her own thing as I was as a little girl and a woman. And if she takes that from me, then I'll be happy. So that's what I'm looking forward to seeing.
Thank you so much for chatting to me today, Sophie. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
A huge thank you once again to Sophie for coming on this week's podcast. She is hugely passionate about motorsport, and I know that came through, and I want to thank her for expressing how much she loves this sport so much and so well. I could have listened to her and spoken to her for hours. She is on Instagram, of course, if you wanted to get in touch. Her main account is Sophie_Og, and her new account, which she mentioned, is Racing Mum Life. As ever, if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe via your favourite podcast platform and leave us a review if that function is available on that platform. It helps people find us, but it also means so much, and you know I'll be reading all of them. You can also get in touch directly if you'd like via my Instagram account, which is Pandeia, Pandeia. Thank you very much for listening, and speak to you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.